accept our help or not. Either way, we're coming with you. Natasha tromps into the woods.
Where are you going?
Rowan whispers after her.
To get the uniform.
Rowan makes a face.
The dead soldier's clothes?
Are you going to stop her? I ask Yatin. He leans against the tree.
There's no sense in it. Changing Natasha's mind is impossible.
Before long, she returns, wearing the deceased soldier's jacket and trousers. Their roominess conceals her womanly shape. She ties her hair up and winds his turban around her head, hiding her long tresses. Although we do not wear turbans when we sleep, Natasha stares at me through the shadows, daring me to forbid her to come along. I have had loyal comrades in the past, men willing to fight for my life. But none of them has ever undressed a dead man and worn his clothes for me. Fine, I say. Off in the distance, camp has gone quiet. We will draw too much attention strolling in after curfew. We'll sneak in when they break camp at dawn. Get some rest. Through the dark, I hear Natasha's victorious accord and Yatin's lamenting exultation. Rowan says nothing. I accept his silence as a bit of amenability. The four of us bed down on the forest floor, sticking to the dry patches preserved by the thick branches overhead. Rowan curls up close to Natasha for warmth. She plucks a leaf from his hair and strokes the locks from his eyes. Kali told me Natasha has a dream of opening an inn someday. I can picture her with a place of her own, caring for weary travelers. Watching her with Rowan drags up a memory. Once, when I was 10 and Brock was 7, he ran away from the palace nursery. Many hours later, I found him huddled beneath a lemon tree in the stony courtyard. Bodies of dead Buddhas were buried under bloody piles of stones, decaying in the desert sun. He had run off after I had railed at him for ruining my wooden sword. I can still recall the imprints of his small fingers seared in the hilt of my favorite toy. That was when I knew Brock was special, and I had to protect him. I threw my wooden sword in the hearth, turning the evidence of what he could do to ash, and never spoke of his abilities. But after that, we both changed. Brock became calculating and distrustful, and I acted as though nothing was amiss. Pretending was the only way I knew how to save him from ending up in that courtyard. I wish I could return to the days when I was his bigger, stronger brother. But we are not masking his birthright from a grudge-holding Raja. We are up against an enemy that not even his burner powers can impair. As the rain drums faintly, my concerns turn toward daybreak, when we will infiltrate the demon Raja's army.
13. Kalinda. Someone kicks my chair, bringing me upright. Inda stands before me, cradling a steaming teacup. You sleep in the strangest places, she says. What time is it? Mid-morning. She shuffles in front of my chair and leans against the open casement. Sunlight falls in behind her. The snow clouds have passed, and the air is warmer. Icicles drip from the window. The tower beacon pushes warmth at my back, adding heat to the warming temperatures. I relit the flame last night, after Tarek left. My memory of his visit is fuzzy in the light of day, pulling apart my confidence in what I saw. Is it possible for souls to travel from the void by shadows? Is there truth to Inanna's descent? Ashwin sent me to find you, Inda says. What are you doing up here? Have you been here all night? I came to watch for Hustin. I slip my hands under the wool blanket. My inner chill is relentless. You don't have to do that. Pons is listening for his arrival. I know, Seeing Tarek reminded me of how Hustin manipulated me into trusting him. The longer I wait, the more Devon's warning weighs on me. But my apprehension may be for naught. Whether Hostin comes or not, we must leave Samia tomorrow morning to meet with the Lestarian Navy. Healer Baka sent this for you. She told me I could find you here. Inda passes me the teacup. I sip the hot drink, savoring its sweetness. She opens her cloak to the autumn air. Her cheeks have more color than yesterday. What were you doing in the infirmary? I needed a remedy for my stomach. Healer Baka was very helpful. While she brewed anise tea for me, we discussed the temple's supply shortage. I wrote Datu Bulan and told him the sisters and daughters will perish if he does not send rations. The carrier dove left an hour ago. I anticipate he'll agree, but should he decline, we could petition the Paljorians. The Paljor territory converges with Tarachind on the north side of Wolf's Peak. The tribe is closer than the southern isles, but reaching out to them is only a fallback. Thank you. We'll wait and see. A thwack, thwack of bamboo striking bamboo sounds below. I join Inda at the casement and look out. Pawns move to the wing flyer from the courtyard, outside the gate near the road. Melting snow leaves puddles that dry in the afternoon sun. In the distance, a sheet of ice still shimmers on the lake, slower to melt, but the warmer autumn day has cleared away the frost from the temple courtyard. Wards wearing sky-blue saris train with staffs in the sparring ring. Their instructor, Sister Hetal, shouts commands. Their staffs are twice as tall as they are, Inda says. They're probably 8 or 9. The age when the sisters start training the wards for battle. They believe Ki wishes for them to mold the wards into warriors, an honor and rite of passage. Inda turns into the sun. She exudes the beauty of her homeland, pearly teeth, gilded eyes like the island sunset, and brown skin with undertones of sandy beaches. Thank Anki the snow is melting. Isn't snow just frozen water? Yes, but manipulating ice and snow aren't techniques practiced in the Southern Isles, for apparent reasons. Inda's attention slides to the stationary wing flyer. I'll be glad to go home where it's warm. Her eagerness to return to Lestari conflicts with her dislike of heights. How did someone who doesn't like to fly fall in love with a Galer? Inda's gaze follows the girls sparring below while she answers. Pons and I met during our Virtue Guard training. His father was a trader of rare treasures and often bartered with Datu Bulan. While he was traveling, he would leave Pons at the palace. His father died during one of his trips, and Bulan took him in. Why does your father disapprove of you and Pons? Frustration packs Inda's every word. Pons is a Janardanian. My family lines trace back to the first families in the Southern Isles. My father wants me to wed a Lestarian and preserve our bloodline. She speaks the last in a gravelly voice, mimicking the Admiral. Parents, the one explanation I cannot relate to. However, I understand the obligation to uphold tradition. Never was I given a choice of which benefactor would claim me, or for what purpose. I assumed women outside the temple had more freedom. Marriage proposals are often sorted out between families. But now I see that custom is also flawed. Still, Inda was permitted to meet a man and fall in love. I was never given that option. We lapse into a contemplative silence. As the wards take turns in the sparring ring, I grow fidgety. Inda, will you please fetch Ashwin and Pons? I have something for us to do. She pushes away from the casement, keen to join me. She must be bored of waiting for Hostin, too. Ashwin may not come, she says. He borrowed every book he could find on the void from the library and was up all night reading. Last I checked, he hadn't found anything of use. After what I learned from Tarek, if I did not in fact imagine his visit, I doubt the location to the gate will be cited in a text. Tell him it's important. I'll meet you in the courtyard. I hurry off, leaving her to satisfy my request. Outside, a pair of girls duel in the sparring circle. The rest of them wait their turn by the weapons rack. An 18-year-old ward I knew from my time here, Sarita, gives them instructions while Sister Hetal observes. Strike her knee and then... Sarita cuts off. Kindred Kalinda. All the young wards whirl around and bow. Sister Hetal scurries to the front of the group. Kindred, Priestess Mita didn't inform me you need to use the courtyard. I don't. I came to watch the wards practice. The girls whisper to each other and Sarita scrutinizes my trousers. My former competitor in the sparring ring has not changed at all. Her shape is still soft yet firm, fit yet feminine. She and Natasha were good friends. From Sarita's glare, she has not forgotten the last time we sparred. I gave her a bloody lip. Pons, Ashwin, and Inda come up the side stairway from the lower level. The girls' high voices pinch off at the sight of the Lestarian warrior, with the partly shaved head, bare legs, and hairy chest. They are equally astonished by Ashwin's good looks, and most of them blush. Girls, protect your innocence. Sister Hetal covers the nearest girl's sight, and the others shut their eyes. Sarita hides her face, but peeks out at Ashwin from between her fingers. Kindred Kalinda, the wards mustn't see the men. Priestess Mita would not presume to send away her prince. I tug him forward, and Pons and Inda follow arm in arm. I thought you were avoiding me, Ashwin says under his breath. I was, though at the moment I cannot remember why. His touch is like a sunrise on a frosty morning.
What are we doing here?
We're introducing these girls to their ruler, I answer, and then raise my voice. Prince Ashwin has come to view your sparring practice. Sister Hetal blathers on about propriety and innocence. I direct my next statement at Sarita, who has lowered her hands to gawk at Ashwin. Would you like to demonstrate your skills first, or should we draw lots? No one moves. The younger girls still have their sight shielded, though many steal glimpses of the men behind Sister Hetal's back.
Kalinda, perhaps we should go,
Ashwin says, shifting uncomfortably. These girls have been locked away long enough. There's a point when innocence becomes ignorance.
I'm sorry, Your Majesty, Sister Hetal blusters. Priestess Mita must hear of this.
She rushes off, and most of the wards lower their hands. Pons bows to them. His kind, wise eyes exude a surprising depth of vulnerability. He does not want them to fear him. Ashwin chews his lower lip, still torn.
They're so young. I don't want to startle them.
The girls hang on his every word, his strange tenor transfixing them. None of them flee or hide. They are sister warriors in the making. Remembering how awkward it felt to stand before a group of men as a lone woman, I push a smile of encouragement at Ashwin. They have never seen a man before, but they're astute enough to recognize your handsomeness. Ashwin's gaze slowly widens.
You've never told me I'm handsome.
No? My voice mellows. I should have. Sarita bows, a curt bend at her waist. There's no need to draw lots. I'll demonstrate my skills for you, Your Majesty. The last of the girls uncover their eyes and blink at Ashwin in wonder. I select a staff from the weapons rack and hand it to Sarita. Go ahead. I'll be your sparring partner. She laughs a little, not in derision, but amusement. You're still skinnier than a bamboo pole. I'm also a 2-time tournament champion. She would probably flee if I told her I am also a burner, but I do not want these girls to fear men or Buddhas. This will be entertaining, Inda says, tugging Pons to the meditation pond. Some of the wards shuffle after them. They congregate near Inda, but do not shy away when Pons asks them questions about their training. More girls move closer to my friends, mesmerized by Inda's topaz eyes and Pons's gentleness. They even request to see his blowgun, and he shows them. I grab another staff and square off with Sarita in the ring. Her entire focus is on me and not the men. She has recovered faster from meeting the opposite gender than I did. I was thunderstruck by Devon for days. Sarita raises her staff to ready position, Until first blood, she asks, reciting the rules of the last time we sparred. Until first down, I correct. I have shed enough blood inside battle rings. Priestess Mita will return at any moment, so I call the start and waste no time swinging. Sarita blocks, and our bamboo poles connect. The clanging vibration shoots up my arms. She glances at Ashwin for approval. I slide closer and knock her in the side of the head with the end of my staff. She bends away and comes around, striking me in the hip. The impact throws me back a step. What's become of Natesha? Sarita tries for neutrality, but I hear her concern for her friend. Natesha lives. She conceded the final rank tournament match to me. Sarita swipes at my nose. I duck, but she gets me on the way back up, hitting me in the shoulder. Natesha would never concede to you. She did. I pace away so Sarita can better view my earnestness. We're friends now.
They are,
Ashwin confirms, standing at the rim of the ring. Sarita adjusts her grip on her staff while considering this news. I check on Pons and Inda from my side vision. The little ones still crowd around them. One of the girls sits in Inda's lap, and another plays with Pons's tied back hair. Where is she? Sarita asks, jabbing. I'd lock her, locking our staffs together. She's in love with a soldier. I think they'll wed someday. Sarita drops her guard, her voice halting. Natesha isn't a palace courtesan anymore? No. She's been freed. Sarita lowers her staff even more. Her incredulous stare goes right through me.
Enough!
Priestess Mita bellows across the courtyard. She and Sister Hatal march for the sparring ring. I lower my voice to Sarita. Much has happened since I left. You don't have to stay here locked away waiting for a benefactor to claim you. This is your life. Claim it. Priestess Mita stomps up to me and yanks away my staff. She tosses it aside, and it lands with a clang, alarming the wards with Inda and Pons.
Daughters, leave us.
Sister Hatal herds the girls together and shoos them inside. After some prodding from the priestess, Sarita drags her feet after them. Once the entry door is shut, and all the girls are inside, Priestess Mita snarls.
You desecrate this sanctuary, Kalinda. Healer Baka told me you've invited the Buddha warlord here. How could you endanger these children? You're their Rani, endowed with the power to protect them. You shame the sisterhood and the land goddess with your selfishness.
Ashwin steps to my side to defend me, but I wave him off. You denied me the right to choose my fate, I say.
The claiming is Anu's will.
What about my will?
What about Jaya's? The gods gave us the five virtues so we could choose to emulate them. They would never force us.
Color rises in her cheeks.
You ungrateful child. You're Rani because of the claiming. That right gave you everything, and it will bless these daughters too.
My heartbeat roars in my ears.
I swear on my mother's grave that none of these girls will be claimed by any man. I'm doing away with the claiming.
Ashwin's posture snaps straight.
You wouldn't.
Priestess Mita sizes up my unflinching glare and reels on Ashwin.
Your Majesty, what would become of these girls? They are orphans. They have no parents, no families to care for them. I cannot turn them out into the world of men unprotected.
Ashwin frowns, contemplating her protest.
The sisterhood temples save hundreds of orphans, the priestess continues. With the war, even more children will need homes and assistance. These temples will be more essential than ever.
Ashwin smooths his hair back, choosing silence. His reluctance to pick a side only serves to strengthen my determination. This will be stopped, I say. He raises his palm to quiet me.
I hear you, Kalinda, but doing away with the claiming can wait.
I fasten my teeth together to keep from screeching. Ashwin closes his eyes, as though gathering patience.
We'll discuss this another time. Meet with Hastin on your own, then.
I set off for the main entrance. My vision blurs from my tears, my chest pumping on each taut breath. I have been fighting for a future I thought Ashwin and I both wanted, a free empire for all. But he and Priestess Mita wish to press forward in tradition. Swiping at my wet cheeks, I push inside the temple in search of the exact moment my freedom was ripped from me.
14. Devon. A bang in the distance wakes me. I go from lying propped against a tree trunk to standing in half a breath. Daylight rests upon the woodland, severing my drowsiness. I groan. We overslept. Natasha opens her eyes from her place curled up against Yatin. I nudge him in the boot, and he jolts, thumping his head against their log. Rowan rouses, shedding sleep like the blanket of leaves that kept him dry last night. Sunup stole into the forest, and the day marched us well into morning, far past our planned departure at dawn. Yatin scrubs sleep from his eyes, and Natasha shoves strands of her fallen hair up underneath her turban. Tightness stretches all my sore, stiff muscles. I peer through the misty woods. The fallen leaves are saturated to a deep crimson from the passing rain. No tent peaks mark the army's camp. We were completely gone from this world, not to have heard the army pack up and leave. I should have anticipated our exhaustion after our taxing days of travel. They're on the move. I brush dirt from my trousers and grab my sword. The others rise alongside me, wide awake. We hustle to the outskirts of camp. The area around the nearest outpost barrack is deserted. I race across the trampled field, my friends right behind me. Up ahead, a group of soldiers and their team of horses pulling a catapult wagon were delayed. The back wheels of the wagon have sunk into the rain-soaked ground. A commander riding on horseback shouts at the four men to heave the catapult. They try to push the heavy artillery free, but it is mired deep. The commander notices us from a distance, our scarlet jackets visible in the morning mists.
You there! Give us a hand!
I run to the catapult and lean my shoulder into the board above a rear wheel. The rest of my group does the same. Mud loosens my footing. I hunker down for better leverage. On the commander's order, we push and the horse team pulls. The catapult wagon rocks forward on the brim of escaping the muck, and then rolls back to its stuck position. Stepping back, I search the area for something to wedge under the wheels. The commander continues to count, and the men push, but to no avail. I return with branches and lay them in front of the nearest wheel. The next time the men shove and the horses rally, the wheel rocks up onto the branches, but the other wheel drags the weight back into the mud. We need more branches, I say. Natasha collects more with me. We return, our arms laden, and set them in front of the second rear wheel and resume our place behind the catapult wagon. The commander, who has dismounted and joined the group of men pushing, leans into the back of the wagon and shouts,
"Go!"
We rock one wheel up onto the dry branches. My footing slips. I switch places on the wagon, shouldering the weight of the lagging wheel, and we muscle it up onto the other branches.
"Forward!"
the commander orders. We impel the wagon onward until the burden of our load transfers to the horse team, and they plod along the trail. I bend over to collect my breath. Yatin pats me on the shoulder, his own rapid breathing loud. Rowan fastens his attention to the other soldiers, and Natasha lowers her chin and tugs at her turban. Light rain lays a thin vapor over the forest land. We trek on, and the commander mounts his horse and paces us. I am certain I do not recognize him. He was not in the military encampment in the Sultanate. But Yatin and I have served with many soldiers, and he could identify either of us, or even Natasha, if he frequented the Raja's courtesan's wing. In short order, we unite with a lumbering ammunition wagon, and our horse team slows to a plodding walk in the long line of wagons and soldiers. The commander rides up to my side. I pretend the rain bothers my eyes and fixate on the muddy ridges on the ground.
"Where did you and your men hail from?" he says, South. We heard word of the Imperial Army marching and came to join you. The southern outpost was abandoned last moon. He replies, fists firm on his reins. I correct my statement as smoothly as possible. We rerouted to Eresh and followed the troops. The commander rides alongside us for several tense steps, evaluating my group. His attention carries over to Natesha. She leaves her chin down. He looks past her to Rowan, and then lingers on Yatin's sturdy bulk.
Do you have experience leading your men?
He asks me. Out of the corner of my eye, I do not miss Natesha's lips twisting dryly.
Sir?
These other soldiers have been hauling the catapult since Eresh. You and your party will take over. He excuses the current team of soldiers, and they advance with the troops on foot. You lead this horse team and catapult the rest of the way to Vani. Don't slow us down.
Yes, sir, I say.
The commander taps his heels against his horse's flank and trots to the wagons ahead. Natesha shifts to walk next to me.
That was unexpected.
Not really, I answer. The first rule of successful soldiering is to make yourself indispensable. No one will look twice at us so long as we follow orders.
How will we look for Opal if we're stuck watching this big hunk of wood?
Rowan grumbles. Natesha had rolled up Rowan's sleeves so the ill fit of his jacket was not so apparent, but the Imperial Army uniform still drowns him.
We'll search at night, I say.
Rowan mutters, his strides short and agitated.
Trust me, Rowan. I know the army. We are safe, so long as we keep our heads down and do our work.
Yatin grunts in agreement, but we both remain on guard and keep our weapons close. Our small unit fans out, Natesha and Rowan up front. Yatin walks just ahead of me, patting his pocket every 10th or 12th stride.
Do you mean to give her that ring or go mad worrying that you've lost it?
Yatin hikes up his trousers, which are roomier since he lost girth.
She wouldn't accept it.
I double-step nearer to his side.
What? Why?
She wants to meet my mother and sisters to make certain they approve of her first.
He scratches his beard.
I told her it would be some time before they met, but she's decided.
Traditionally, Yatin would meet with Natesha's father to discuss the wedding, but her parents are deceased, so she can make the arrangements herself. A strong rapport with his family must be important to her. But I would wed Kali regardless of whether I had my mother's approval. Our speed stays consistent as the day wears on, and we soon surpass clambering wagons and catapults. Once we reach the center of the ranks, I slow to uphold the pace of those around us. A mediocre position in the marching line will draw less notice our way. My feet already hurt, and my back aches. But I ignore my protesting body, and settle into the familiar monotony of military obedience.
15. Kalinda. The claiming chamber is locked from the corridor, so I enter an adjoined room around the corner and close the door behind me. The cold, gray inspection chamber that is used for the first stage of the claiming ritual is empty. Circling the hollow area lit by wall lamps, I feel goose flesh spread up my arms. Here, in this very spot, the other recipients and I stood nude before Healer Baka for evaluation of our physical health. A practice to determine whether we were fit to be shown to the benefactor. An inner door leads to the next chamber. Near it, on a table, is a pot of henna. The sisters used the henna to draw the mark of Anki down our spines. The single wave represented that we were in submission to the most fearsome benefactor who had ever visited our temple. I am tempted to throw the pot and shatter the memory of Tarek's arrival, but I pick it up and cradle it close. I once carried the mark of the kindred, dyed in henna on the backs of my hands. The number one was a symbol to all that I was the Raja's first wife. Tarek may have avowed that I will only be remembered in association with him, but I earned my rank and nobility despite him. And it all began in the next room. On a whispered prayer for courage, I opened the door to the claiming chamber. The lamplit cave of a room is smaller than I recall, but just as chilly. A mosaic of blue, white, yellow, and red swirls across the tile walls. A muslin veil hangs from ceiling to floor. In front of the veil, the red line on the ground is the same, chipped and worn. I set my toes on the painted mark. I stood here, blindfolded, while Tarek slunk out from behind the veil and first imposed his touch on me. All at once, I am blind again. I crumple to the floor and hug the henna pot close. Gods alive, how many girls were claimed here? How many shook in terror and shed tears? The gods had a hand in my claiming, but how many others can say the same? Sobs wrench out of me. I cry for Jaya, Natesha, myself, and every other ward whose future was stolen in this chamber. For how long I weep, I do not know. But my inner winter emanates into the tile floor, muddying where my misery ends and the poison begins. Finally spent, I lie in the dimness, too heartsick and frozen to leave this tomb of innocence. Footfalls echo through the open door, compelling me to push myself up. Ashwin fills the doorway. He takes in my swollen eyes and red nose. Pons told me you were here. He enters the claiming chamber and turns his attention to the room itself. He runs a fingertip across the colorful wall that is too cheerful for the terrible ritual held here. At the veil, he reaches for the cloth, but withdraws before touching it.
I'm sorry I disagreed with you in front of the priestess. My deepest apologies for giving you the impression that I would retain the claiming. But I wish you had discussed your motives with me before announcing your intentions. I would have approached the priestess with you, Kalinda. We could have told her we wished to do away with the claiming as a united front.
His level-headed explanation negates my anger, for Ashwin is not the true source of my umbrage. I didn't think you'd understand. He stares at the chipped red line on the floor.
I'd like to try.
I, too, want him to understand why he can never repeat his father's actions. Tarek claimed me here. Devoid of tears, I am plain in my recounting. I was blindfolded and naked. He touched me. Ashwin's gaze sharpens to daggers, and I amend. My hair, mostly. The rite took only a minute, but it was the longest of my life.
A minute is too long to be humiliated and terrified.
Ashwin crosses the room and sits beside me, one knee against his chest.
The wards are safe. With the war, no benefactors will come to claim them.
He leans his shoulder into mine. His touch is daylight in this miserable place.
I'll change whatever you wish about the temples. I depend on your judgment. Especially now.
His voice collapses to a whisper.
I'm afraid my decision to unleash Uduk will be our ruin.
I grip his knee. You had to do it.
I still brought this war upon us. Because of me, we may have no future. I need you.
He shakes his head and starts over.
I beg of you to trust me.
I didn't mean to exclude you. I trust you. I do. Ashwin toys with the gold cuff on my wrist. His gold cuff. He curls his fingers around my arm, and his thumb grazes my pulse. His caress smolders into me, lessening the constant cold, and I sink into his body. His mouth steadily lowers to mine, and he says,
You came into my life like a star. The answer to all my wishes.
He rubs his lips lightly over my own. Heat sparks between us. I lift my chin, yearning for more. He clutches at my waist and delicious warmth sears into me. My mind goes fuzzy, like I am stretching out in a pool of sunlight. This feels so right. No, more than right. Necessary. I drag him closer. Oshwin inclines me back, lowering me to the floor, and presses his body against mine. I splay my hands across his shoulders, and a vision overwhelms me. Oshwin and I live in the turquoise palace. We sleep in late and stay up into the night. We take our meals in his private atrium and rule our people from twin thrones. I bear him an heir, a son, a burner who will someday rule the empire justly and with compassion for his people, an example set by his father. Oshwin loves his son as much as he loves me. He defers to me in all things and honors me before his court of wives and courtesans. I am his singular favorite, his kindred, and only love. The strong image is irrefutable, but it is not mine. The palace looks different than I remember, a fine duplicate, but missing details that authenticate the vision. The vivid picture transitions. Oshwin and I are entangled in the sheets of an enormous bed. He wants more heirs. He wants me. Marry me, he whispers against my lips. His hand slides up the back of my tunic. Before I can stop the vision from returning, we are in a bed once more in my mind's eye. Ashwin's hand creeps higher, tugging up my tunic, both in the claiming chamber and in the palace. I want him to stop, but I am locked in two realities. No. I'm not in the palace, and this is not my dream. My dreams always include Jaya and Devon. Always. He kisses across my cheek, down my neck.
Marry me, Kalinda. Be my kindred. Fulfill my heart's wish.
He nibbles at my throat. I push him away and leave my hands against his chest to prevent him from coming closer. His complexion is flushed and his lips damp. His hooded eyes still project the dream that played inside my head. What did you say?
Be my wife.
No, the part about your heart's wish.
You fulfill the wish of my heart.
He leans in for a kiss. I hold him back. My insides rattle apart. I twist from him, resting my forehead against the cool tile floor. Oh, gods. I should have seen it before. Your heart's wish? I'm your heart's wish.
Kali.
I shove at him. Get off me. Don't ever touch me again.
I don't understand. What did I do?
I adjust my tunic and rise on quaking knees. The wall patterns whirl around me. You wished for me. When you unleashed Udug, you imagined me with you.
I imagined ruling in the palace. You know that.
Oshwin climbs to his knees, his hair disheveled from my hands stroking through the dark strands. My hunger for his warmth implores me to return to his arms, fasten my lips to his, and never ask another question. Did your heart's wish include me ruling beside you? Ashwin's eyes gleam his sincerity.
I've wished for you since we first met.
His answer hits me like a staff to my stomach. I bowl over and the icy sickness inside me spreads fast now that we are apart. Inda said she sensed Oshwin lied when he told the Datu we are not intended to marry. In Oshwin's heart, we are betrothed. When we touch, my pain eases because he wished for our union. Oshwin wears a blank, slackened expression.
Kalinda, I told you how I felt about you before I unleashed Udug.
But you wished for me. He returns my accusation with a series of rapid blinks. This isn't real. I'm drawn to you because you wished it. The color in his cheeks drains away, and he presses his fist to his lips. Another stone-cold thought strikes me. Devon thinks I'm in love with Oshwin.
If this is all an illusion, then why?
Oshwin waves at the floor, and what just took place there. You wished that I'd rule the Empire alongside you. Udug cannot defy your bidding. I grip my teeth together to ward off another round of shivers. Udug's powers are still inside me. I'm safe from them when I'm near you.
Then stay close.
Ashwin steps forward to defend me from the cold, but I shuffle back and wrap my arms around myself. The violation of his imposed will crawls across my skin, stronger than my need for warmth. My teeth chatter involuntarily. I lock them down, but not before Ashwin sees.
You're in pain.
Please keep away. Ashwin did not manipulate me intentionally, but I do not trust myself near him. He balls a fist and strikes at the veil.
Why won't you let me help you?
Because I love Devon. I clutch at my aching chest. He's my heart's wish. Everything about Ashwin dims and sinks. His demeanor, his posture, his raised fist. Whatever light he's shown for me extinguishes. Why couldn't he be Devon? I demand of the gods. Why did you tie me to a throne and a man my heart has not chosen? If I thought I could fall in love with Ashwin, I could set aside Devon right now. In his considerate, honorable way, he knows the choice is mine and loves me enough to walk away. But I never wanted Ashwin. Even if I had, any possible future with him has been permanently skewed. I slip off his gold cuff and hold it out. This is yours. Ashwin opens his mouth, but no words come. He reaches for his cuff and his finger brushes my palm. My need for him hurts so badly tears spring into my vision. I pull back, and his chin falls to his chest. I'm sorry, I whisper. The door opens. Sarita sees my watery eyes and averts her gaze. Kindred, the Lestarian woman asked me to find you and the prince. She said for you to meet her and the baldish man in the courtyard. Inda would only summon us for one purpose. The rebels must be close. Sarita watches us from the corner of her sight. Ashwin's hair is still mussed and his tunic offset. Sarita is too innocent to conclude what we have been doing here alone. But I have a clear memory and suffer the ensuing guilt. I should have guessed my connection with Ashwin was contrived. That will be all, Sarita, I say. She hesitates in the doorway. I'd like to go with you when you leave. The complication of another person on our journey is too much to consider now. I'll think on it. Thank you. She exits the way she came. We should go. The prince still will not look at me. Ashwin, please. He tips up his head. His eyes frigid. I risk my willpower and edge closer. Tempting soul fire wafts off him, physical solace within my reach. But I hold myself taut. I'm still with you, Ashwin. You have my loyalty through whatever comes next. I know you'll give the Empire your all.
Don't patronize me. I may be younger than you, but I'm not a child.
He tugs down his tunic jacket, a meticulous gesture Tarek was known for.
You may still be kindred, but this is my empire, and the gods will hold me responsible for what comes next.
Ashwin storms out, his footsteps sounding like Tarek's the day he walked into my life and flipped my future upside down. Raja Tarek was a vengeful man, turned hard-hearted after the woman he loved, my mother. Jilted him for my father. But I am not my mother any more than Ashwin is his father. I pick up the henna pot I left on the floor, dip my finger into the sticky paste, and paint the backs of my hands. Soon enough, the henna will dry and flake off to reveal the mark of the kindred. Then Ashwin will be reminded that my fate is also tied to what becomes of the Empire. And he will see that I will continue to fight to make certain that the most important aspect of his heart's wish comes true. Ashwin will be the next Raja. That is the only destiny I will accept.
16. Devon. Late into the afternoon, the plodding wagons spread out. The weariness of the day strings us apart and heavies our steps. Long trails of men wind from the woods and descend into the lowlands, where the air thickens with the dank scent of wet land. The sky opens to unstoppable stretches of blue over verdant grasslands.
Men toil in the rice fields and the higher wheat fields, both crops recently planted for the coming winter. Though I scrutinize every wagon and group of soldiers we pass, I have not seen or heard anything about Brock or Opal. The farther we walk, the more my premonition festers that they are in danger. Ahead, our troops trudge through a village. Our catapult is one of the last to pass through the roadways lined with ramshackle huts. Yatin was raised not far from this area. His widowed mother and two eldest sisters worked long days in the fields while he and his other siblings kept house. Women and children watch us roll through from their worn doorways. About 100 strides in front of us, Manas, riding on horseback, stops at a hut. He and another soldier speak to the woman. All four members of my unit conceal our faces as we march toward them.
"Where is your husband?" Manas demands.
The middle-aged woman props a child on her hip, an older boy beside them.
"The gods took him to the beyond 3 years past."
Her burr is rich and throaty, much like Yatin's accent.
"Any older children?"
"A 15-year-old son. He is in the rice fields."
"Send your son here to fetch him,"
Manas says, and then calls to the other women shying away from the soldiers in their huts.
"Raja Tarek requires all able-bodied men ages 14 and older to take up arms and join us."
Though Manas states no punishment for non-compliance, his tulwar hangs off his hip. Most women shut their doors. Widows are common in the Empire, and the lifespan of field workers is short. The young son of the woman Manas first addressed starts out for the fields, but Manas bends down from his saddle and snags him by the back of his tunic.
"How old are you?"
Manas asks as we steadily march nearer.
12,
he squeaks.
"I served the Raja as his bootshine boy at your age. Fetch your older brother and return here to bid your mother goodbye. You'll work as a water servant."
My lip curls, and I fist my sword. The woman yanks her son from Manas's hold.
"Please, I need my sons. Someone has to work in the fields and earn our keep."
We come up to them, the wagon nearly in line with Manas's horse. Every other door on the road is closed. Manas regards the woman without a single yarn of compassion.
"Send them both."
He posts the soldier with him to stay and enforce his orders, and then rides to the next road. The woman sets her younger child down, a girl, and grabs her son to her chest in a double-arm hug. Her daughter cries at her knees. The sight of them, the mother and her two children, throws my mind back to my mother, brother, and me. The nursemaids had to drag us away from her after our weekly visiting hour in the courtesan's wing. Each time, Mother had to return to entertaining the Raja or his men of court. Our hearts were crushed. Brock took our partings especially hard. Afterward, I would hold him on our double cot in the nursery bunk room while he cried himself to sleep. We roll up to a family's rundown hut. Our wagon is the only one in sight on the road. The soldier Manas left works to pry the mother and son apart, but the woman will not forfeit her child. The more the soldier wrenches, the more hysterical and desperate she becomes. Finally, he draws back and strikes her. She cries out and falls against the door jamb. The scene around me gives way to another. Mother's hour with Brock and me has come to an end. She dallies for one last hug, surrounding us in the softest silk and sweetest jasmine. A man barges in and tells her he's tired of waiting. I stand between them, but he shoves me to the floor and hauls her off by her hair. Brock's hands start to glow in fury. I shield him from their view. His fingers singe my sleeve and nearly burn my skin. I hold him close, but I cannot cover both his eyes and my ears, which echo with mother's fading scream. The soldier scuffles with the 12-year-old. I step away from the slow-moving catapult and pull my kanda.
"Leave them be."
The soldier turns on me, and his eyes bulge. I recognize him as well. He and I were in the military encampment together in Eresh. He forgets the boy and draws his sword on me.
General Manas! He calls.
Manas has strolled around the bend in the road, out of sight. No other soldiers are near. I can scarcely hear my quick breaths over the woman's wailing. The soldier shouts louder.
General! Cap!
Afternoon, soldier.
Natasha purrs, pulling off her turban. Her dark brown hair falls around her dirt-smudged face. The soldier is so stunned by the sight of a woman, and a beautiful one at that, he does not see Yatin throw his holiday until it is too late. The blade sinks deep into the soldier's chest, and he collapses before the family. The woman abruptly stops crying and picks up her young child. I shuffle forward to examine the fallen soldier. He is dead, or will be soon. Yatin speaks from near the wagon.
Rowan, stay here and redirect all sound. Warn us when the general is coming. Natasha, put your turban back on.
Rowan kicks up the subtle wind, concentrating on Manas's whereabouts. One would not detect the mood in the skies unless already suspicious. Natasha quickly ties on her turban. Yatin strides past her to the family's hut. Adrenaline takes over, overriding my shock, and I help him lug the body inside. Yatin retrieves his holiday and kicks dirt over the trail of blood on the ground.
Hide, and don't come out until the army is gone,
he tells the woman, who nods avidly.
Don't speak of this, and you'll be left alone.
She ushers her children inside, closes their door part way, and pauses.
Thank you, Yatin. Your sisters and mother will be overjoyed to know you're well.
I startle at his given name. She shuts the door, and Yatin and I hustle back to the wagon, into Rowan's winds. 2 minutes, maybe three, have passed since Manas rode off. Natasha's turban again covers her hair. We lead the horses onward, and the next wagon comes around the bend. Rowan weakens his gusts, and we march on. My heart beats 2 times faster than my feet.
He's coming, says Rowan.
Manas rides nearer to us. At my prompt, Natasha tucks a loose strand of her hair down the collar of her jacket. Manas's horse canters past our wagon and slows. He looks back at the woman's door. He remembers he left a soldier there. Farther up the line, a commander calls for the general. Manas circles his mount and rides onward into the troops ahead. I release a quick breath, my heart flailing against my ribcage, and pray that no one pursues the disappearance of one soldier in this vast army. Once we are clear of the village, I address Yatin.
Who was that woman?
A friend of my mother's. We can trust her.
We are not near Yatin's village. That was his village. Where is your family's home?
Not far from here.
His sadness hushes me. Though this is the closest he has been to his family in many moons, he cannot stop to visit them. Had I been paying better attention, I would have suggested he and Natasha meet his mother and sisters and rejoin us later. If Natasha had not distracted the guard long enough for Yatin to throw his holiday, we would be finished.
I'm sorry, I say. You did the right thing.
Yatin slides an indirect glance at Natasha.
I had to do it again.
As would I. And that worries me. I once told Kali that sometimes the only solution for peace is war. But we are not here to fight these men or change their minds about their leader. We have come for Brock and Opal. And the sooner we find them, the sooner we can run far away from the demon Raja and his army.
17. Kalinda. I meet Inda and Pons in the temple courtyard. Night is falling, and with it the clear sky leaves an opening for the cold winds pushing in from the north. Much of the snow has melted away, and ice forms on the puddles that remain. Ashwin arrived ahead of me. From his hard-set jaw, he is still simmering over our encounter in the claiming chamber. Pons hands Ashwin his machete and says,
The rebels are waiting near the lake.
They wish to meet you and the kindred alone. I cannot tell how many there are. At least one of them is a Galer. I received her request to meet you, but nothing since.
The rebel Galer must be redirecting the sounds of their movements to conceal their numbers. An uncomfortable beginning to our diplomatic engagement. I draw my dagger. I'll throw up a flame if we need you. Inda nods. Her powers will not be of much use to us in this cold, but she is still an adept healer. Why am I thinking of needing a healer? Because someone gets hurt every time we interact with the rebels. Not this time. Tonight we broker peace. Ashwin and I exit through the gate. We turn away from our wing flyer by the road, into the chilly wind, and pass through the alpine forest. A figure waits outside the tree line, in front of the frozen lake. Even from a distance, I recognize Anjali, the warlord's Galer daughter. She wears black robes with a red belt cinched at her waist. Her ebony hair is tied back in a long, thick braid. Anjali was one of the Raja's top four favored women in his court, but she secretly worked for her father as a palace informant. Her winds swirl predatorially around her, a convex slithering of currents. We stop a fair distance away, and Anjali lulls her gusts. I sense within myself for my powers. My inner light is faint, but accessible. Kindred, your majesty. Anjali bows, her welcoming discordant with her smirk.
We were expecting the warlord, remarks Ashwin.
Our exhalations shimmer in the air like silver plumes. My father is preoccupied with matters in Vani. As you are aware, the demon Raja's army is marching there. Anjali's intense dark eyes strike a balance against her oval chin, and her subtle curves are offset by a slim waist. Our informants brought us disturbing news. Would you like to hear?
Tell us the message your father sent you to deliver, I reply, annoyed at her meandering discourse.
Like a sidewinder snake, Anjali waits until her opponents are distracted by her indirect weaving, and then strikes. The demon Raja is growing his powers.
He doesn't need to grow his powers, I say. He never tires.
The longer he is out of the void, the weaker he becomes. Unless he feeds off Buddha soul fire. Anjali wrinkles her nose. You know that disgusting thing you burners do? Parching? Udug does the same, only he parches his victim's whole soul.
The rebels have also learned the voider's name, but Ashwin does not disclose if her knowledge about the Udug upholds his own findings.
Creatures of the Evernight thrive in the dark, Anjali explains. They're the strongest in the shadows. Through feeding off Buddha soulfire, Udug is expanding the powers he brought into our realm. By the time he reaches Vani, he will be more powerful than the demon you battled. He will be unstoppable.
Ice radiates in my gut, stemming from the cold fire strangling my inner light. Udug's powers work the same way on me as they do the rest of the world. The Lestarian Navy is on its way, says Ashwin, calm and focused. With the rebels also on our side, we'll have sufficient Buddhas to defeat Udug.
She wags her finger at him. You unleashed the Voider, yet you need Buddhas to vanquish him.
I don't share my father's hatred. An alliance with the rebels will ensure a place for Buddha virtue guards in the Empire's future.
An alliance is one answer, Anjali admits. But we have another.
Ashwin boosts his chin. And what's that?
For you to die. Anjali's smirk widens at his flinch. Udug is tied to you through your heart's wish. If your heart stops beating...
She makes a poof motion.
He returns to the void.
My powers hum just below my skin.
Your theory is unfounded. We won't know until we try. Your Majesty, Anjali leers at his title. You unleashed Udug. Do you have the courage to send him back?
I step in front of Ashwin. The prince won't forfeit his life.
My father told me you'd say that, which is why, for every hour the prince lives, one of the palace prisoners will die in his place, The warlord will start with your favorites, your Rani friends, Parisa and Ishana. Or maybe your servant, Asha? No, it will be Shyla, the one with the baby.